This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The continued tensions in the UMass system have dominated the news all this week, and this is how we're going to start the conversation with our Week in Review guest today. First, the turmoil at UMass Boston, where all three finalists for the chancellor's job abruptly withdrew from consideration. Now, that happened after public criticism from faculty members and a faculty statement that called all three candidates unqualified for the job. Sharon Lamb, Executive Committee member of the UMass Boston Faculty Council, told our show this week that the faculty feel ignored, especially after UMass President Marty Meehan bought Mount Ida College for UMass Amherst students.
The process was problematic from the beginning, and we really felt excluded. Mount Ida was just sort of like the straw that broke the camel's back.
Faculty also voted no confidence in Marty Meehan. UMass Boston will now have its second interim chancellor for the time being. And Boston Mayor Marty Walsh weighed in on this week. He offered to help find a chancellor for UMass Boston. He said Wednesday he won't let UMass Boston go the way of Mount Ida.
We can't let that happen. I won't let that happen as the mayor, and I don't think the state reps can't let that happen. State Senate can't let that happen. Legislature, governor's office won't. It's an important resource in our city. It's an important resource for too many people.
And Governor Baker says he has concerns.
Look, I'm disappointed about the way this whole thing has played out. And as I said before, the Mount Ida issue, I believe, is one that I'm glad the Attorney General is going to continue to investigate, because we need to know more about how that happened.
So, what's next for UMass? Joining us to talk about this and more news of the week is Michael Curry, former president of the Boston NAACP and member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, how are you? Also with us, Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Hi, Ed.
Hello.
So, Michael, let's start with you. What do you think of what's been happening at UMass and the tension between UMass Boston and the Mount Ida thing and everything else?
Yeah, it's been confusing. I think first and foremost, congratulations to that graduating class over at UMass. I think they were graduating yesterday, and I got a chance to spend time at Fontbonne Academy with their graduating class, an amazing group of young women, maybe some of whom might even look at UMass as an option. It's disturbing. I think, one, I reacted when I heard the faculty call the candidates unqualified, because I know from a little bit I know of a few that they are qualified. So I challenged that. But then when I reached over to the campus and had a conversation with particularly faculty of color, I got the underlying message, which was this is really about Marty Meehan. Mm. This was about a lack of confidence in him. I think it's a little bit of fallout from the Keith Motley situation with his removal from UMass. Folks are not happy. Not happy with the lack of transparency, the lack of communication.
And about the Mount Ida purchase, primarily.
Well, probably a combination of all of the above, the search process, the Mount Ida, and even the fallout from the Keith Motley situation. People don't feel included in the process. And whether that's a governance issue that they're challenging, it may be less about these three candidates and more about their impressions of his leadership.
Hmm. Ed, your thoughts?
I agree with all that. I also think that UMass Boston is feeling a lot of political factors at once. I think they're seeing the inequality in Boston and the city. I think they don't have the resources that they need. I think Dorchester is going through changes all around them. I think they're seeing a lot of higher education institutions struggle with their finances. So I think they have a morale crisis there, and they don't see that things are going to get better. So any crisis that comes up is going to hurt them, even if it's small. So I don't think it's really about any one of these things individually. I just think that UMass Boston is feeling insecure about the future. They feel like that they can't, you know, succeed in their mission, and they're looking for someone to blame.
Well, we heard the governor, Marty Walsh, the mayor of Boston, say that they would like to help. They want things to improve. The attorney general, of course, saying she wants more oversight of private colleges because of what's happening at Mount Ida. And she's weighed in about this, the whole Mount Ida purchase as well. So is it time for state officials and Boston officials to step in here and do something?
Yeah, I think it's too valuable of a resource. It's a training ground for many of the young people that will go on to serve our economy. I think there's no question. I think credit to the mayor, credit to the rest of our delegation and local elected officials who are willing and forceful about weighing in. I think it's necessary. I know when I talk to folks, too, this interim period, the interim leadership, not just at the top, but throughout the organization, throughout the campus, is really a concern for many. There's a lot of work to be done, and we need all hands on deck to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, but, you know, they say this, right? Everyone says they want to save the system. They want the system to be strong. It is our state public university system, after all. But the legislature never seems to fund it. Are people going to put the money where their mouths are? Ed, your thoughts?
I hope so, but you have to have a leader who puts it in those terms to say that if Boston is booming the way it is and we're pulling all this money and all this talent and so many people are doing well here and we have this organization that's supposed to be an institution or an engine of equality for students that really need it, someone has to say that costs money. And maybe UMass Boston can reduce its expenses, but I don't see any way forward from UMass Boston's problems without more money from the state legislature.
Hmm. Absolutely. I agree. Ultimately, we got to fund our priorities, and we have that challenge here in the Commonwealth.
Well, I've heard this for I don't know how many years, that the legislature needs to make this a priority. And what would have to happen to make it a priority, do you think, for lawmakers?
Well, I think ultimately there's the leadership. I don't know if there's been a general collection of elected business leaders coming together to call for some changes over, quite frankly, throughout the UMass system, but particularly UMass Boston. And then working with the legislature, you know, we have a very conscious leadership on both sides in the House and Senate. I think that there's a conversation to be had. And me just knowing the leaders that I've dealt with in both the House and the Senate, I think people would be receptive. But an argument needs to be made about cost efficiencies, about growing the system so that the college is competitive, because that's really the issue, is whether they can compete and draw in students from across the state and, quite frankly, across the country. Hmm.
You know, we spoke with Latin American Studies professor at UMass, Reyes Coltayachaya, and she told WBUR that she'd like to see the relationship between UMass Boston and UMass President Marty Meehan improve. Let's listen.
The first thing we need to do is work with the new acting chancellor, see if she can help us repair the connection with the president's office, see if she is able to handle the budget the way it needs to be handled immediately.
Ed Lyons, Michael Curry, Ed, you first. I mean, is this it for Marty Meehan?
I wouldn't say that. He's not new to this. I just think that, you know, he's in a leadership vacuum right now, and is he going to step in and do that? I don't think he can do that by himself. I think someone else has to stand by his side and bring along either support in the legislature or some sort of a vision. So I think he'll be okay for a while, but I think that he needs to get some help soon.
Michael?
Yeah, you know, I've served on a community college that I will not name while I'm here, but they were going through similar challenges on the community college level. I've been a part of other institutions and called in to be a part of their teams during the transition. There's a clear message here that's going throughout the state, which if you're a stubborn leader that's not willing to change and adapt and fix those issues and be transparent and inclusive, you will probably not stay in that job. And I think that's what we're seeing across the state and, quite frankly, across the country.
Mm. What's the role of the Board of Trustees, though? I mean, does that help, take some of that away from Marty Meehan?
Well, and the faculty that I talk to, they're implicated in this as well. The folks that I talk to on that campus are equally as frustrated with the Board of Trustees as they are with Marty Meehan. Mm.
Okay. Well, let's move on to federal courts here in Boston, because there were some really emotional hearings this week, and there will be another day of hearings next week. And these are about the authority of federal immigration agents. The hearings in Boston federal court have resulted in a promise from agents who say they will no longer arrest undocumented immigrants who are visiting government offices trying to gain legal status. Now, these hearings are being held by federal judge Mark Wolf, and he's been questioning ICE officials about their practices. And during the days of hearings this past week, the judge has played a recording that's very emotional. It's a recording of Lucimar de Souza, who's a Brazilian immigrant who was separated from her children for 3 months after she was detained at a government office in Boston. And here's a clip of that recording of her emotional reunion with her 10-year-old son.
Vai!
So very emotional tape played during this hearing with Judge Wolf. I'm wondering, Ed Lyons, what do you make of these hearings in Boston this week?
You know, I think it's hard for us to accept that the great American consensus around illegal immigration is coming apart. I think that I grew up near New York City, and, you know, it was sort of like, you know, if people are here illegally, but they kept their nose clean, and weren't stealing anybody's job, that we were just never going to get around to deporting them. It was sort of a way in which, you know, maybe if we got in trouble, things would come up. And we're really debating about, like, you know, how much trouble does someone get in before we deport them. And it's sad that something else is happening, something that's very alien, something that's happening in federal facilities in our own neighborhoods. And I think people just aren't used to the idea that, wait a second, there are things that are really against our values we've never seen, well, at least not in my lifetime, that are actually happening. We have to sort of accept this is happening and speak out about it.
There's actually an audit showing that some people were, you know, detained inappropriately. I guess it's probably the safest way to say it because there are so many people, but it's dozens of people who were detained inappropriately. I'm wondering, Michael, what do you make of these hearings and Judge Wolf doing this, and what do you think will happen from here?
Yeah, credit to Judge Wolf. And this is and the first thing when I heard of this story and this family's heart-wrenching story was I'm reminded that elections have consequences, right? And quite frankly, I serve on the Advocacy and Policy Committee for the National NAACP, and we often make the point that elections have consequences, and judges, the appointment of judges across the country have consequences. There is an anti-immigrant sentiment across this country right now that doesn't make sense. It's not something that's in the best interest of this country, and it doesn't protect us. It doesn't make us safer. And under this presidency, we'll see a lot more of this type of stuff happening. And thank God for judges that are able to check this sort of policy change.
But, you know, there are people who say if you're here illegally, you can't be here. Breaking the law, right? I mean, there are maybe not so many in Massachusetts, but there are people who think that this is the way that things should be handled.
And it's just a reminder, I think, you know, I wish people knew American history more, right? Because I think we tend to forget, no matter what country you're coming from, that there are a lot of illegal immigrants that were here that came here as for a better opportunity. And go to any, there's a new name for the Office of New Bostonians, but go to any of those swearing-in ceremonies where people have been here, but then they went through the process, and now they're proud Americans who get to contribute. And the reality is there's millions of them that are waiting for the opportunity, and they're not violent, and they're not criminals. And the language right now is just disturbing.
Well, Ed, do you think that Massachusetts could face any repercussions for having these kinds of hearings, for a federal judge here having these kinds of hearings, from the feds or anything like that?
Yes. I don't think we can assume that the federal government is going to sort of let Boston be Boston or anything like that. I wouldn't be surprised if there was some sort of retribution or loss of funding. I think this administration is quite serious about inflicting its views on us, and we should be ready for that to happen.
Okay. Well, another contentious issue here, the debate about sports and the national anthem. So the new NFL policy this week requiring all players to stand during the national anthem, or if they don't want to stand, they can stay in the locker room, but they must be respectful. So NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell says this new policy allows the league to punish teams if their players do not act properly.
We want people to be respectful at the national anthem. We want people to stand. That's all personnel, and make sure that they treat this moment in a respectful fashion. That's something that we think we owe.
President Trump, who last fall said players should be fired if they refuse to stand during the national anthem, weighed in on the policy yesterday.
I don't think people should be staying in locker rooms, but still, I think it's good. You have to stand proudly for the national anthem. Well, you shouldn't be playing. You shouldn't be there. Maybe you shouldn't be in the country. You have to stand proudly for the national anthem.
Michael Curry, your take on the national anthem and standing or staying in the locker room during games.
Yeah, it's funny. Sometimes I hear Donald Trump think and speak. I tend to think of like Tiananmen Square or North Korea. I forget where I am sometimes because I think he doesn't realize that it's your choice to recognize the flag. And if you are, you know, I quite frankly, protections for people who aren't that American, but are Americans, who may not want to stand out of protest for the hypocrisy or the actions of police officers in government action who shoot particularly unarmed victims. I think he's missing the point here. And the point is, and it's now translating into the NFL ownership and the lost revenue, which is driving their decision in the NFL, that this is ultimately about people's rights. And the right, if I'm a football player in the NFL, you don't require me to stand. And I, quite frankly, I'm going to come out of the locker room and I'll pay that fine to stand on the field and not recognize the ceremony. So to me, this is just another Donald Trump cultural shift that's happening in the country.
And Ed, what about you?
Well, it's been hard to watch this whole process the past few years, that I think a majority of Americans disapprove of this. I think it's 86% of Republicans. So I have many, many friends that are on Facebook and Twitter saying that they think this is wrong. They support the new policy. And, you know, these are the people that tell me how great Dr. King was on his birthday every year. And what I tell them is that, you know, polling in the 1960s shows that about the same percentage, about 60% of people thought that the Freedom Riders were wrong, that Dr. King's actions were wrong, the lunch counters, sit-ins were all wrong, telling them, you know, we think this is going to hurt your cause. You're just doing it wrong. You know, so I want to say to all these people I know who, you know, are against the kneeling and all that, I want to say, if you've ever wondered who were those white people who opposed Dr. King and what he was doing and said he was doing it wrong, you know, who discounted the underlying racism, I say, like, it's you. You are the white person who opposed Dr. King. And I know that's got to be really hard for you to hear. And maybe you should think about that before you celebrate his birthday again next year.
And just to add to that, who are those white people and who are some of those people of color who also opposed Dr. King? Because I think, you know, my favorite phrase, it takes time for truth to catch up to history.
Right.
There'll become a time 10 years, 15 years from now, we'll look back on this and we'll know who was wrong in this debate.
Mm. Well, you know, and the players apparently are divided as well. And we had a debate on this on the show yesterday. So we have a statement from former Patriots player Chris Long, who's now with the Eagles on Twitter. He said, all this is, this policy, is fear of a diminished bottom line. It's also fear of a president turning his base against a corporation. This is not patriotism. Don't get it confused. The owners don't love America more than the players demonstrating and trying to take action to improve it. Okay, there's one perspective. However, the Boston Herald spoke with Matt Light, also former Patriots player, Hall of Fame inductee, and this is what he said. What they did was issue a statement saying we respect our men and women in the armed services, while at the same time giving the players the ability to not respect the men and women in the armed services. To me, according to Matt Light, they outlined a worse scenario before it was never even in the handbook. In league policy, it was never okay not to stand for the national anthem. So if you think about it, they defined the right to not stand. They've literally defined by policy that guys can openly disrespect the men and women in the armed services. So different perspectives here, obviously, from the players themselves. What do you make about that division? Because, of course, we've heard this, that what you're doing by not standing and showing respect for the flag is actually going against the members of our military.
Well, and I'm sure, and I will agree on this, I think the frustrating part is people don't follow the ball. They don't pay attention to the conversation. This was never about a disrespect for our men and women in the armed services. It was never that. And not one athlete I've talked to, not one person of color or a white person who supports the right to take a knee or not stand was ever looking at this as a disrespect to our people in the armed service. This was about a statement about a country that often contradicts itself and, quite frankly, treats its citizens of color with major disrespect in many ways, not just in police action, but in other ways as well. And this was their way of saying, you know what, we won't tolerate that. And we're going to use our celebrity and this opportunity on television to make that statement. For those who think it's a disrespect to our military, you've gotten to the wrong conclusion, and it's unfortunate for a serious conversation.
Or for those who say the NFL is like a private company, right? I mean, their rules, they can do it. Ed, your thoughts about that?
Sure. I think this is about culture. This is about sort of who we are as a country and what we're willing to tolerate, and learning some history. You know, I've been taught by black friends that the black protest is never welcomed in America, even in this day, and nobody wants to say that. So I'm not comfortable with everything that Black Lives Matter does, you know, but I look at it and say, boy, I don't want to be that, you know, person, you know, telling my great-grandson and going to a Colin Kaepernick High School the fact that I was on the wrong side of this, you know. So I just, I can't believe how the president puts out this point of view, people fall in line, the conversation is changed, becomes about all these false things. I want to say, you know, they're not mooning the flag. They're not giving the middle finger. They're not turning their back. They're not walking out. They're kneeling. I can't think of the last time I kneeled to show disrespect to something in my life. It's actually the opposite. And it's a shame the fact that people are adopting a language they're hearing out of Washington and from conservative media. This is somehow about, you know, the military. I think that's just completely wrong.
And just to add to that, I think the fact that, and I've heard this across the black community when we say this, is the fact that they kneel means they love this country even more because they're challenging it to live up to its ideals. And that actually shows a deeper level of love for this country.
And I expect that we will continue to see this play out in the upcoming season. Yes?
I hope so.
I hope so as well.
So let's end with our hubbubs. Those are the brief stories that caught our attention this week, maybe didn't make it above the fold. Ed, your hubbub this week.
So last weekend, I took my children to the celebration of the Roxbury Cultural District. We went to the First Roxbury Church and to the bowling center. This is sort of the city and a lot of foundations put a lot of money and effort into trying to promote Roxbury in a time of great change for Boston, especially as Boston is thinking a lot about racism and equality. I think we need Roxbury to succeed mostly on its own terms, and I think we all should take an interest in seeing how that how that's going down there, because if Roxbury fails, the city fails.
All right. Michael.
A little above the fold, but one that I thought was important to mention, which is the hiring of Tito Jackson to run a pot company, Verdant Medical Incorporated. I think back to my years as NAACP president, and I got a call from a black a person who wanted to participate in the dispensary of marijuana and be considered for bids. It was the first round, and he didn't have an opportunity. And it was really about the fact that we can't be left out of this industry. Despite how we feel about marijuana, it's legal now in Massachusetts, and I'm very concerned that there will not be black representation in the wealth that it creates or in the people behind these decisions. And the fact that Tito's taken his job, I think, is a promising side of the story.
All right. All right. Well, my hubbub is a little bit musical, so I want you guys to listen to a little bit of this. Okay, any guesses who that is?
Is that the teenage girl who won some sort of
right?
Pop culture?
Yeah, good, good.
I wouldn't have guessed that it was, but I remember I heard the voice before.
Bryn Cartelli from Longmeadow, Massachusetts, who at 15 years old, she became the youngest person to win on NBC's The Voice this week. You know what she gets?
What does she get?
A recording contract and a car that she's not old enough to drive. Yeah, so there you go. So Michael Curry, former president of the Boston NAACP and member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Also, Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, we get a dose of inspiration from some area commencement speeches. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.